Today's Taisho will be on case 66 in the Blue Rock Collection, Pien Lu. Ganto laughed loudly. Engo's introduction. Adapting himself adroitly to circumstances. Displaying the spirit to capture a tiger. Attacking now from the front, now in the flank. Planning to seize the rebel. Combining light and dark. Holding fast and letting go. Dealing with deadly serpents. This is the master's task. Main subject. Ganto asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "From the western capital." Ganto said, "After the rebellion of Koso had been suppressed, did you get the sword?" The monk said, "Yes, I have got it." Ganto stretched out his neck before the monk and let forth a great yell. The monk said, "Your head has fallen." Ganto laughed loudly. Later, the monk visited Seppo, who asked, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "From Ganto." Seppo said, "What did he say to you?" The monk recounted the story. Seppo gave him 30 blows and drove him out. Secho's verse. Since the rebel was suppressed, the sacred sword has been restored. Why the laughter? The master knows. Too small a reward, the 30 blows. One gains, one loses. I want to thank everybody for coming here today to practice this beautiful, beautiful path of Zen. This is our last sit together for Saturday sit together for 2007, and so we're saying goodbye to 2007 and we're saying hello to 2008. I hope you had a very good sit this morning. In the Hakuin Zenji Zazen Wasan, which we just recited, the Hakuin Zenji's Song of Zazen, there's a line that could be translated like this. As for Zazen in the Mahayana, as for Zazen in the great way, we have no words to praise it fully. I think that's so true, you know. I mean, this path is, I think, just so beautiful, so wonderful. People come in to sit with us sometime, and they're just beginners. And many times they give it a try and they don't come back. You know, that's quite common. But occasionally somebody will come in and at the end of the experience they will they'll be very grateful. And people who try this a little while have an experience a little bit like this. You know, you come in and things are distressing you, things are troubling you from the day. And you'll sit down on the cushion, and during the whole period of meditation, maybe two or three sits, all of those problems from the day keep bothering you. You know, they come back on the cushion as you're meditating. Or you sit down on the cushion and all these other strange things pop up in your head, and you just keep trying to get back to your breath, or back to mu, or back to your koan, and during the whole time it's a struggle. But then, so often, people notice when they get up, the bell rings, we have our tea, etc., and we get up, the lights come on, and And people notice that they're much calmer. They're much more centered than they were when they sat down. Even if during the whole sit their mind was like a beehive buzzing with bees. I myself have had a very pleasant and easy life. I've had no big tragedies. It's really been great. But like everybody, I've had experiences that are difficult to handle. You know, I know that you know, it's never easy, for example, to have somebody you love die. And you know, a person of my age sees a fairly large number of people that he cares about begin to disappear from the world. So when I was just 40 years old, my father died of cancer. And I was with him for maybe 5 days before he actually died. And, you know, I loved my father. And this was really the first time I was close to anybody who was dying. And I was sort of taking care of him, along with his wife and my sister, who was an oncology nurse, as it turns out, cancer nurse. Was at that time. She's a nurse practitioner now, but she's very skillful at helping people die. You know? So she handled the technical aspects of morphine drip and so on and so on. But it was very challenging. You know, as you can imagine, if you haven't had that experience yet, when your parents die, it's going to be a challenge for you. And I have to say, I got up every day and I did my zazen, you know, and it helped me enormously. You know, it would be like a lot of turmoil, all kinds of conflicting emotions. You know, when you're with somebody you've been deeply involved with for, I don't know, 40 years, it's never just a simple story. There's many complex emotions. There are things that have not been said that should have been said. You know, all kinds of issues that never get resolved. And that makes it more difficult too. And you just sit down on the cushion and you watch your breath, or you call Mu, or you work with your koan. And at some point, all of this complexity goes away. At some point. Maybe after you get off the cushion, and it may be in the middle of the sit. But at some point, it's like being released. It's like having these heavy weights taken off your body, and you can breathe freely. And it's like the, you know, sky opens up, and there's this blue sky. And it feels so good, right, when that happens. Doesn't always happen. But when it happens, it's so precious. I think it's priceless. I just think it's priceless. So, you know, when my father died, I did zazen every day. And it helped me to help him, really. It helped me to help him a great deal. I was able to be present and helpful and not overwhelmed by emotions and so on. And I was able to sort of usher him through this transitional state, you know, very, very, I think, effectively. I think he had a pretty good death. So, you know, my brother died a few years ago of cancer also. And my mother recently, and my mother-in-law. These are all people I've been around, seeing them go into this transitional state. And in each case, it's been difficult, and doing my zazen has really helped me enormously. And like everybody, I've had a number of setbacks in life, just like everybody else. I mean, if you try to do anything in life, you're going to have setbacks and defeats. So, you know, I've been fired. I've been you know, I failed to get jobs that I really wanted. I've been insulted in print on several occasions. And that, there's not much you can do when you're insulted in front of 12,000 people, you know. You can't do much about it, you know, it's in print. So you just get back on the cushion and you know, your heart's a turmoil. And you watch your breath and you watch your breath, or you call Mu, or whatever your koan happens to be. And it's the most wonderful transformation in the world. I mean, I think it's the most precious thing in the world. When I found Zazen, I was a pretty unhappy person. I think I was often depressed. When I think back on it, I think I was quite depressed. Sort of like chronically depressed. And I was just an unhappy person. I was almost like paralyzed by negativity. And when I started doing Zazen, it was just those moments where the clouds would open up and you could be one with the blue sky were so wonderful, so liberating. That is so precious, and it's so rare in this world, isn't it? It's so rare. People desperately seek it. Desperately seek it. But this kind of opening, this kind of liberation, I think is very rare, and really, it's just as Hakuin Zenji says, it's we have no words to praise it fully. I even think that's not good enough. I think this is the most majestic, at least in my own life, most majestic thing I've ever encountered. Those moments where everything clears away. You know, we get so trapped in our fears and our anxieties and our desires and our aspirations and expectations. And we are so torn apart by disappointments and the injuries that life does to us. It's almost like being suffocated sometimes. And people just desperately go here and there, you know, trying to find some release. When I was a little boy, my father was in charge of a military base in Southern Virginia, a naval base in Southern Virginia. He was in charge of the security for the base. And this was like a top security installation. And his job was to make sure that the integrity of this operation was preserved. And there were things on the base that were like top secret, so, you know, so to speak. So military, naval planning, naval training, and things like that that were, you know, of importance. This was during like the Cold War, so people thought the stakes were very high. And my father was under a lot of pressure a lot of the time. And I know he was very unhappy sometimes. The pressure was so great. I know he had trouble sleeping. And he used to on a Saturday, he used to just get in his car and drive around sort of obsessively. My father wasn't like an intellectual, you know. He didn't have, couldn't read books, and he would just get in his car and drive around, trying to drive away from, I guess, his problems, you know. And when I was a little boy, one of the first things my father taught me was how to make him a cup of coffee. And then the other thing he taught me was how to make him a martini. So when he came home, he could sit down and I'd make him a nice martini, and he told me how to put the vermouth in the glass and swirl it around and then empty it out and then put the vodka in and the olive, just like a bartender. And my father was trying to get released, but I don't think the alcohol worked very well. You know, he also had a serious smoking problem. And one of the ways he dealt with his tension was to smoke. And of course, he eventually died of lung cancer. So the martinis and the cigarettes didn't work that well. And I know he always had a lot of pressure. I think it really aged him, you know. And we all have pressure, but if you come in and you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath and you throw yourself into your practice wholeheartedly, you know, there will be these moments where it's just absolutely like liberation. It's so precious. It's like being ageless, returning to a kind of ageless innocence, kind of ageless happiness, you know? It's really beautiful. So precious. Now, I don't think this... When I first found this, I just thought, this is it. I don't know what it is, and I don't know why I like it. But I hung on to it for dear life. And every day I do this, and I just can't get enough of it. I just love it so much, you know, and it's so liberating. I love that experience, that freedom, you know, that. In this koan, a monk comes to visit the temple of Master Ganto. And Ganto asks, he goes for an interview, the monk goes for an interview with Ganto, and Ganto is interested in understanding how far this monk has gone on the path to awakening. So Ganto asked a monk, "Where are you from?" This is like a big Zen question, right? If you go to study with any other teacher, and you go into Dokusan and the teacher says, "Where are you from?" You should be sure that this is like a Zen question. And you should be worried, you know, because it's not. You say, "Oh, I'm from, you know, Asbury Park, New Jersey." You'll be like the guy in this koan, okay? And this is like the ultimate question, right? Where are you from? Where are you from? That's a big question. Where are you from? I don't think there's any bigger question. Right? So Ganto, he doesn't beat around the bush, you know. Did you have a nice trip? You know, is your room warm enough? You know, Ganto said, "Where are you from?" And the monk said, "I'm from Asbury Park, New Jersey." He says, "I'm from the Western capital." See, now, the Western capital was the scene of civil unrest. And there was a rebellion against the government. And many people were killed, including lots of monks got their heads chopped off. So Ganto, the monk says, "I'm from the Western capital." And Ganto says, "Oh, the Western capital. After the rebellion of Koso had been suppressed, did you get the sword? Did somebody give you the sword? In other words, did they chop off your head?" And the monk said, "Yes." He said, "Did you get the sword?" In other words, did you get the sword at the back of your neck? And the monk says, "Yes, I've got it." So then Ganto stretches out his neck before the monk like he's having his head chopped off and let forth a great yell. The monk said, "Your head has fallen." Okay. Now, these Zen conversations can be pretty mysterious sometimes. You know, they're pretty hard to understand. Because monks do all kinds of crazy things in these stories. So, for example, in one story, Joshu comes into a room and is asked a question about Zen, and to answer it, he puts his shoes on his head and walks out backward. So, when you read a story like that, you think, what's that all about? Actually, there's something important about that, you know. putting his shoes on his head is really like a significant act. It's an expression of his awakened mind, really. If you do Zazen long enough, you stop being so afraid. And when you stop, you know, most of our problems are caused by fear. You know, most of them are caused by fear. And fear paralyzes us. It makes us, you know, when you can't get out of fear, you get depressed. And when you get depressed, you're paralyzed, you know. And so I think fear is like the big problem for human beings. And all the other problems sort of follow from that. I think people can be very greedy or very selfish. Also, this is just mostly fear. So basically, you know, most people are paralyzed by fear of various kinds. Fear they won't be loved, fear of actual physical violence, fear of rejection, you know, it goes on and on. But it's a powerful motivator. And, you know, it's really quite wonderful when the fear goes away and we can be present in the moment. And it's possible to live a very different kind of life, you know. When fear has gone away, it's like your body and your heart and your mind have been in a kind of like lockdown state, like in a prison, you know. So in a prison, if you want to go eat, they have to open the door to your cell, right? And then you have to wait for all the other prisoners, and then they take you into this other room. Where there's a door that has to be opened, and you go in and you sit down and you eat. And basically, when you're done eating, they open the door again, you go into the hallway, and then they open the door into your cell. It's like lockdown, everything. Pat Andres has been involved with an educational program for people who are in prisons. And actually, they're on the way out of prison. They're in a kind of what's called a halfway house. It's halfway between a prison and being free. And on one occasion, she invited me to come. Actually, I think on several occasions, she invited me to come down and do some Zazen with people in the halfway house. These are people who have made all kinds of human mistakes. You know, there weren't really like murderers in this group. There were people who have embezzled money from the places where they worked. There were people who have committed robberies, assaults. Some of these people have, you know, they're ordinary people. You know, they have college degrees. One of them was a chef at a very good restaurant. He was the embezzler, you know. And they were nice. They seemed like nice, decent enough people. We did some Zazen, but they were in lockdown, you know. So when they wanted to come to our little workshop, they had to sign in and sign out. And they were escorted in and they were escorted out. And I had to have a little badge myself. And when I went to the bathroom, I had to go get permission to go to the bathroom. Actually, we live this way quite often. We just don't have any visible guards, you know. By the time you're about 25 years old, you're in lockdown a lot of your life. You're constantly encountering these obstacles in yourself and in the world. They're like inner obstacles, you know. When you do, and by the way, we don't want to break through them because we're afraid. We're afraid of what will happen to us if we do. And actually, you know, it's kind of safe being in jail, right? Because you can't, generally speaking, if you've got your own cell, you're pretty safe. You know, so being in lockdown is like, it's not free, but it's not, you're not in too much danger. Right? And I think basically people are kind of tired all the time and sort of grouchy because they're in lockdown. And my idea is that when you do Zazen, you know, you start having that blue sky experience. And you begin to have a much greater degree of openness in the way you live your life. It's like the doors get opened. And some people find that a little frightening, you know. Some people find it quite frightening, and that's why it might take 10 or 15 years to finish your Zen training. But there's something about being free that's really wonderful. And when we're not in lockdown, body, mind, and heart, you know, we feel more energy. We feel more alive. And there's really joy, you know. And you begin to act differently. You have more spontaneity because you trust yourself and you trust life more. It's not like one day you come in on the cushion. You come in and you do Zazen and then, you know, wow, you know, what a change. It's not like that. It's little by little by little. You sit on the cushion. There are all your problems. You work through them. And all of a sudden, you know, you feel a little better. You don't say, oh, my life has been transformed. You know, now I'm not afraid. You know, that's fantasy. Right? You just feel a little better. And then you go to work the next day and there's new sources of stress and so on and so on. Then you come back and you sit on the cushion. And, you know, after a couple sits, you feel a little better. And then one day you come in and you sit down on the cushion and it's like, wow, what is this? It's like the sky opens up and the blue sky is everywhere, you know? And you go through that process for 10 years, you know, 5 years, 2 years, whatever. And it begins to change you. You begin to have a kind of spontaneity. You begin to feel like you're not at war with the world, you know, and you're not being persecuted by the universe. And you can act with a kind of freedom and joy, real joy. And this is Zen spontaneity. You know, those of you who are working on the Mu Koan, you know, you have to come in and shout Mu. You know, you have to come into the Dokusan room after meditating all day and go and call Mu. You know, and it's so hard not to be in lockdown. You know, it's so hard not to be all locked up. So you try to call Mu, but it's just ridiculous. You know, you feel self-conscious. There's no energy. You know, it's so hard. It's like so labored to do this, so artificial. It's hard to get out of lockdown, but if you just keep sitting, you know, you have these moments of freedom. And they might just be like 2 seconds. But little by little, it changes you. And you have this kind of great spontaneity. And so when Master Joshu is asked a question, he puts his shoes on his head and goes backwards out the door. Yeah. And it sounds absolutely crazy. But this is the behavior of somebody who's really been working on getting out of lockdown for 50 years. And it makes a big difference. You know, you become a much different person. That kind of spontaneity and freedom are present without self-consciousness, you know? And so when we hear this story about Joshu, it just seems crazy, but actually it's an expression of his awakened freedom. Now, the thing is that in this story, Ganto says, where are you from? And the monk says, I'm from the Western capital. And so Ganto thinks, oh, that PU, that's a terrible answer. But he gives him another chance. He says, after the rebellion, did you get the sword? And the monk says, oh yes, I've got it. And Ganto stretches out his neck like his head is going to be chopped off and lets forth a great yell. And the monk says, your head has fallen. Now, let me tell you, this is like the Cliff's Notes to this koan, okay? This monk's answers are pure bullshit, okay? Not spontaneous. He's faking it, right? He's faking it. Take my word for it. And Ganto just, at the end of this exchange, Ganto just laughs loudly. We don't know why. That's part of the koan. Now, you know, we shouldn't be mad at the monk. You know, he's doing his best, but his answers aren't really spontaneous. He's trying to be spontaneous, but he's not there yet. But he doesn't know he's not there yet. This is part of the koan, you know. So the monk says, you know, Gyanto stretches out his neck like his head is going to be chopped off, gives a yell, and the monk says, ah, your head has been chopped off. And Gyanto laughs loudly. So the monk thinks, you know, I might have something here. So then he goes to visit Seppo, and Seppo and Gyanto are really good friends. They practice together much of their lives, and they have the same teacher. And so the monk goes to Seppo, and Seppo says, where are you from? The monk says, oh, I just came from Gyanto's temple. Seppo said, what did he say to you? And he tells a little story. And Seppo says, oh, that is a terrible answer, you know. And gives him 30 blows with the keisaku. So you're not supposed to have contempt for this monk, you know. He's just not able to liberate himself yet from his lockdown condition. Yeah. And both Gyanto and Seppo are trying to help him in different ways, you know. And the heart of the koan is this laughter, you know. Gyanto's laughing. What does that mean? You know, why is he laughing? So I'm not going to talk about that because that's something I hope we might be able to do in a koan. I mean, in a dokusan situation. This issue of how beautiful it is to get out of lockdown is really quite important, you know. about a week ago, I got an email from somebody at Murray Grove, where we have our sesshins, where we hold our sesshins. And then I got an email from a woman whose name is Barbara Miller. And Barbara Miller is a Unitarian minister in South Jersey. And Barbara Miller let me know that a woman had died who had been coming to our meditation sessions on Saturdays at Murray Grove. So we have sitting here half a day every other Saturday, and on the other Saturday we have meditation practice at Murray Grove now. You might not be aware of this. And as is so often the case, that group has grown very slowly. You know, so when these things start, usually like one or two people show up, and then maybe one of those people doesn't come back. And then two or three people show up, and maybe none of those people come back. And then, you know, two people show up, and one of those people comes back. So little by little, you have, you know, four, five people, six people, and a little group begins to form. And that's sort of what's been happening at Murray Grove. But last spring, and in the summer, a person came to sit whose name was Stacy Hagen. And she was a very nice person. And she had done some meditation in the past and wanted to pick it up again, and had heard about our group. So she started sitting with us pretty faithfully. In fact, she came to one of our, you know, I allow people from Murray Grove to come on the Saturday of Sesshin and join us for a morning of meditation, because we would normally have meditation there on that Saturday morning. So there's an open invitation to the members of the Murray Grove group to come and join us for Sesshin. And of course, Jane comes every time and stays quite a bit, and a few other people have come. But and Stacy came. And then I didn't really, I think after she came, I didn't see her again. I didn't see her again, if I'm remembering correctly. And I wondered what happened, you know. A lot of time, you know, nobody follows up, you know. They come to practice and then you never hear from them again, and you never get a letter saying, you know, I moved to Montana or something. You just don't know. So I didn't hear from her again until I got this call from Barbara Miller, and she said, you know, Stacy has died over the weekend, and she told her husband how much it meant to her to be doing this meditation practice. And so I said that we would recite the Heart Sutra for her today at the end of the Teisho. And I also sent a copy of the Heart Sutra to her husband. I just wanted to talk about the Heart Sutra for a minute. You know, we recited it this morning. And we recite it, of course, in the Japanese phonetic pronunciation of Sanskrit. So it doesn't make that much sense, which is good, right? Because we're reciting it with the part of ourselves that has no birth, no death, and no language. So that's the deepest kind of recitation, by the way. That's blue sky. That's the voice of the blue sky, right? But all the same, the translation is interesting too. The Heart Sutra is actually the heart of Prajna Paramita Sutra. So the Heart Sutra is part of a larger collection called Prajna Paramita. And Prajna means like wisdom or knowledge. And a paramita is often translated as transcendental. So this is like transcendental wisdom. But literally, paramita means other shore. So this is like the wisdom of the other shore. Right? So Heart Sutra is a great heart of the wisdom of the other shore. And it could be translated like this. The Bodhisattva of compassion, deep in the consciousness of the other shore, clearly saw that the products of the senses are empty. And this ended all suffering and distress. Shariputra, she said, form is no other than emptiness. Emptiness is no other than form. Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness exactly form. Sensation, perception, mental reactions, and thought are all like this. Shariputra, all things are essentially empty. Not born, not destroyed, not stained, not pure, without loss, without gain. Therefore, in emptiness, there is no form, no sensation, perception, mental reaction, or thought. No ear, eye, nose, tongue, body, mind. No color, sound, smell, taste, touch, object of thought. No seeing and no end of seeing. No ignorance and no end of ignorance. No old age and death, and also no ending of old age and death. No suffering, no cause of suffering, no cessation, and no path. no wisdom, and no attainment. Since there is nothing to attain, the bodhisattva lives by the consciousness of the other shore, with no hindrance in the mind, no hindrance, and therefore no fear. Far beyond delusive thinking, right here is nirvana, complete enlightenment. All Buddhas of the past, present, and future live by the consciousness of the other shore, attaining complete enlightenment. Therefore, know that the teaching of the consciousness of the other shore is the great sacred mantra, the great vivid mantra, the unsurpassed mantra, the supreme mantra, which completely removes all suffering. This is the truth, not a fantasy. Therefore, set forth the mantra of the consciousness of the other shore. Set forth this mantra and proclaim, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond, praise to enlightenment. You know, the Heart Sutra is supposed to be a conversation between the bodhisattva of compassion, Guanyin, Canon, or Avalokiteshvara, and Shariputra. Now, Shariputra is a historical person who it's very likely Shariputra actually lived. The Buddha, when he began to teach, ran into a very advanced practitioner of meditation who had been sitting for many, many years trying to break through to awakening without success. He was an extremely advanced practitioner, years on the cushion, and his name was Shariputra. And when he met the Buddha, he had his Daikensho, his great awakening, and he became like the Buddha's right-hand person. So the Buddha actually said, Shariputra is like my son. He said, if you want to know what I believe, just ask Shariputra. He used to say that. He would say, Shariputra is my son. You want to know what I believe? If I'm not there, just ask Shariputra. He understands this completely. And now Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of Enlightenment, is not a real historical person. There wasn't a person probably called Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara, you could say, is the archetype of human compassion, of compassion that's in every human being. Inside of you, there's a deep compassion, right? So this is like a dialogue between Shariputra and enlightened mind itself. Yeah. And basically, it's talking about emptiness. Yeah. So one way to think about it is that when Shariputra had his Daikensho and encountered a boundless compassion, he saw that everything was inherently a blue sky, that everything had no inherent nature. Everything was mushin. This he understood to be the unfailing path to liberation. Clears away all suffering, without residue. Now, you know, people who practice Zazen may get relief, but they may not fully appreciate how wonderful it is, you know. And people who encounter mushin, at first, you know, can't possibly understand what it is. You know, people encounter mushin even without doing Zen. You know, you might do something like this. You know, if you go for a run, a jog, and you really have a workout, and you come home and you sit down, for a few minutes, your mind is just blank, right? You know, you're just sitting there, no thoughts, your mind's absolutely blank. And if you close your eyes for just a minute, there's just nothing there, you know, just nothing. Sometimes people have that experience when they wake up in the middle of the night and can't remember like where they are, you know, it's all dark. And for just a minute, you know, the mind is still and there's just nothing there. And they just think, oh, that's nice, and they roll over and go to sleep, you know. Or after you've gone for a jog and your mind is blank, you think, okay, I've got to go wash the car, you know. Then you turn on the radio and listen to the radio. When you do a zazen, you come in and sit on the cushion, and you know, every once in a while, you know, sooner or later, you're going to have these moments where your mind is just blank and dark. There's just nothing there. And you know, typically, I mean, at least in my own case, you know, the first time I had that experience, I thought it was kind of interesting, but I didn't really, I thought, well, that's it, you know, that's a nothingness, that's blankness, you know. But let me just promise you that if you keep going back to that place, it will be absolutely, it will change everything about your life. That, you know, when people close their eyes and they don't see anything, and there's a split second where they have no thoughts, they don't think that's heaven, you know. They don't think that's important. But I want to tell you that that's like the door to enlightenment. It's so simple. It's right there, you know. We get so caught up in all of this stuff. Fear mostly makes us so. We get so preoccupied. We're so concerned, you know, with this and that. And the truth is, like, the door to enlightenment is always right here. You know, right here. It's kind of an irony. It's not necessarily it's kind of sad in a way, you know. Because people, you know, it's like people don't appreciate, because they can't, what's right at their, right behind their eyelids, you know. You think, well, that's nothing. You know, I close my eyes and yes, I don't see anything. You know, it's blank. And my mind doesn't think any thoughts for a second. So what? But you know, don't listen to that mind, you know, that says, so what? If you stay in that blankness long enough, you realize that everything we think about reality is, much of what we think about reality is actually basically untrue. You know, it's really either half true or untrue. If you stay in that blankness long enough, everything about your life will be different in the most positive way. That blank little blankness is the door to enlightenment. You know, it's the door to liberation. It's the door. When you close your eyes and you have no thoughts, this is really quite similar to being dead. And you say, well, it's not being dead, but, you know, how do you know? How do you know? We say dying on the cushion, and what we mean when you do meditation, you should die on the cushion, and we mean you should go into that blankness very deeply. And you can say, well, okay, that's symbolic language, but how do you know? Maybe it's not. Maybe that's death. Yeah. But if that's true, you know, it's true. You know, you get off the cushion, your heart is still beating, you know, physiologically not dead. But again, you know, these are all just assumptions we make about life. We say, well, I didn't die. I mean, I was on the cushion, my heart was beating. But again, how do you know? You know, you know, I'm not asking you to accept any of this. I'm just saying, you know, keep an open mind, okay? Many of the things we think are true turn out to be not true if you do this long enough. But the good news is, you know, actually, even though it's very painful, it's not easy to be born. We don't remember it, but it was a very difficult experience, you know? I'm not talking from my own memories either, because they're gone, right? But, my sister has had two little boys, and she was talking to me about how difficult it was to give birth to them. And she was telling me how much pain she was in and so on. But you know, nobody ever thinks about the baby. You know, it must be excruciatingly painful to be a baby coming out, you know. It must really hurt. It hurts the mother. You know, the baby has, it must really be a harrowing experience, you know. You get crunched up. First, you know, your beautiful world is gone. All the water is gone. You're not swimming anymore, you know. Suddenly you're, you know, I don't know what, you're, all these wet tissues are all around you and you can't breathe, maybe, who knows. And then you're scrunched into this little tube, and it's probably very painful to be scrunched like that, you know. And then you come out and there's all this weird stuff going on and you can't make sense of it, and, you know, somebody might slap you on the bottom. It's a, you know, it sounds rough, right? So it's not easy being born. It's a challenge, right? And it's not easy entering the state we call death. You know, it's also a challenge. But, you know, it's not necessarily as terrible. You can say, well, you haven't died, and it's true. I'm still, my heart is still beating. But, you know, if you keep practicing Zazen, you know, you might find that even things like death, which seem so unthinkably terrible, are really not so terrible. Really, you know, not so difficult. You know, it's not easy to be born, not easy to die, but, you know, people are, on the other end of being born, there's something quite wonderful. And when we die on the cushion, anyway, something quite wonderful always follows that. So it's just possible we have less to be afraid of than we thought, you know? Less to be afraid of. It's hard to appreciate the possibilities because we live in lockdown. But if you just keep, like, giving yourself freedom, everything you experience will be very different at some point, really and truly. I mean, you still get up and eat, you still have a job, but everything is quite different. And, you know, many of the things we're really terrified of are not so terrible. You know, actually, you know, I have to admit, I haven't died. But, you know, I'm quite sure that what we call death is actually quite an amazing experience. Quite an amazing and maybe even wonderful experience, yeah? And when we die on the cushion, that's also a pretty amazing and wonderful experience. So please keep sitting. Yeah? The world is really a great place to be. And the more you sit, the happier you'll be to be in it. Ganto asked a monk, "Where are you from? Where are you from?" Well, when I close my eyes, there's no thoughts and everything's blank. That couldn't be important, right? Maybe it is. Ganto asked a monk, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "From the Western capital." Ganto said, "After the rebellion of Koso, did you get the sword?" The monk said, "Yes, I've got it." Ganto stretched out his neck before the monk and let forth a great yell. The monk said, "Your head is fallen." Ganto laughed loudly. "Why? Why?" Okay. Later, the monk visited Seppo, who asked, "Where are you from?" The monk said, "From Ganto's place." Seppo said, "What did he say to you?" The monk told the story. Seppo gave him 30 blows. "Since the rebel was suppressed, the sacred sword has been restored." "Why the laughter?" "The master knows. Too small a reward, the 30 blows, one gain, one loses."